Ho, 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 Merry Christmas or whatever your holiday of choice is. We hope you enjoy this last episode of 2025. Hope your year was as great as you wanted and your next will be even better. If you want to wrap it up with a little bit of continuing education credit, you should be checking out ICU101.com. That's the Intensive Care Academy, our other learning platform, which has about a million videos on all sorts of educational topics, a lot like this one. ICU101.com. Otherwise, on to the show. Let's hear about ammonia. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. This is Brandon Odo, and unfortunately, I am not back with Brian Bowling. Brian is in the midst of a power outage down in Kentucky right now. So unless his linesmen evoke a sudden repair in the next hour or so, we're probably not going to see him, unfortunately. But who I am glad to have with us here today is Dr. Prem Kandia, who is a neurointensivist and a surgical and liver transplant intensivist down at Emory. And Prem's particular interest is ammonia, liver failure, and encephalopathy, and has really kind of sunk into this topic cognitively. His account on Twitter is Captain Ammonia. So I want to sink in this topic today because ammonia, I think, is confusing to a lot of people. And it's one of those topics where many of us have a very superficial understanding. Meaning if you ask someone who does critical care, probably internal medicine and other things too, about hyperammonemia, they'll say, oh, you know, it's bad for your brain and it can make people encephalopathic and, you know, cirrhotics will have that and we need to clear out their ammonia. And that's sort of the end of topic. They don't really have a deeper understanding. And I think we're going to see today there's actually a lot more to this, both even in those more common contexts, and also some, you know, maybe less common but potentially important drivers of this sort of syndrome. So welcome, Prem.
Thank you, Brandon. Happy to be here.
So let me just tell you about a patient who turns up in your ICU. So a 39-year-old female. She has a history of MAFLD, as they keep changing these acronyms, you know, fatty liver disease, let's say. And also had a history of a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass some 6-7 years ago. Rheumatoid arthritis, takes rituximab for that, some hypertension, some depression. And she came to the hospital because she's been having a few weeks of pretty nonspecific symptoms. Generalized weakness, poor appetite, sort of a failure to thrive picture. And then she shows up in the ED feeling just sort of groggy and unwell. Her initial workup, she has kind of modestly abnormal LFTs. Her transaminases are a little elevated. Her Bailey's are a little high, but really nothing that anyone is too impressed by. So they don't really know what's wrong with her. She's admitted to the regular floors, and the internal medicine team takes her until over the next few days, she develops a worsening encephalopathy to the point where she's just about comatose. So they upgrade her to the ICU and send sort of a general broad workup. And somebody has the bright idea to send an ammonia level, and it comes back elevated. 220, pretty high. And now everyone's saying, well, what do we do with this? This is not what we expected. And perhaps one answer is to not send tests when you don't know what to do with them. But give us, like, the elevator explanation for what is the deal with ammonia. You know, where does ammonia, you know, build up, arise from? What's the basic physiology here? Is it toxic to the brain? And if so, why? No doubt there is a whole lot of biochemistry we can dive into here, but just give me a few sentences on this.
So during digestion, nitrogen in the gut is absorbed, and this can be formed by amino acids, including glutamine, and this is converted by the enterocytes to ammonia. So there's significant gut production of ammonia. Ammonia then goes to the liver. And the liver, using the urea cycle, converts ammonia to urea, which is excreted by your kidneys, right? So think about the first layer of protection of the body from ammonia is your liver and your kidneys, because urea obviously is excreted by your kidneys. Then any ammonia that surpasses the liver or bypasses the liver is then detoxified by muscle to glutamine. And this is muscle glutamine synthase. And this, in turn, has to go back to the gut and then enterocytes on the capillary surface will convert this glutamine back to ammonia and goes back to the liver again to form ammonia and it's and excreted and to form urea, I mean, and it's excreted by your kidneys. So through this process, the brain is always protected from ammonia. But if you have in pathologic states, the system starts to fail. And where this fails is dependent on what the underlying process is. So suddenly if the liver is failing, ammonia is the urea cycle shut down in acute liver failure, for instance. Now it can't detoxify the ammonia, and hence ammonia spills over and sometimes overwhelms the muscle and then goes to the brain, and it can affect the brain in numerous ways. And the same in cirrhosis patients, it's not so much that the urea cycle is shut down, it's just they've developed portosystemic shunts that go around the liver. And so ammonia now bypasses the liver and in cirrhosis patients, you also have sarcopenia that can affect the detoxification of ammonia by muscle. And so the brain sees ammonia in this context. Now, about ammonia and the brain, it's a complicated topic and it's a whole podcast by itself. But in essence, the astrocytes try to detoxify the ammonia and accumulate glutamine within the astrocytes. And this has some mitochondrial injury as well. So the brain can swell, but the swelling is twofold. It can be cellular swelling, which is cytotoxic edema, or it can be vasogenic swelling, which is more of an interstitial edema, or both.
Let me try to summarize and you tell me if I got that right. First of all, the ways that ammonia either leaves your body or becomes non-toxic are multiple, right?
Yep.
The liver is involved,
yep.
But the kidneys are also involved in clearing it, and the muscles too, yep, have a role, as well as the gut itself. And most people, I think, recognize the liver and maybe the gut, but the others they may not think about too much.
Yep.
And then the impact on the brain, first of all, it is truly toxic. And I just highlight that because some of the things that we'll measure or pay attention to in toxic scenarios are really more of a marker for something else. But this is a truly toxic compound that doesn't belong at high levels in the brain. And the injury is both related to edema, pure vasogenic edema, we might say, a swelling problem. But there's also direct cellular injury as you develop high levels of ammonia.
Yeah, exactly. So, cellular injury, particularly the astrocytes. The astrocytes indirectly support the neurons, so neurons can get affected. And then there's the swelling component. And then there's a third component, which is an osmotic component, right? And that also complicates the picture because you do get this osmotic astrocytopathy, where the astrocytes swell because of the osmotic load from not necessarily ammonia, because ammonia is not osmotically active. Its concentration is in micromoles, but ammonia is converted to glutamine by the astrocytes, and glutamine is more osmotically active and can cause a shift of water into the cells.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, if you think about this vasogenic component and the edema, you might think, oh, the ammonia is attracting water, but it's sort of indirect, huh?
Yeah.
Ammonia per se is not a very effective osm, but it tends to turn into more effective ones. But
exactly.
The question that always arises in different scenarios is, should we measure this? Because it is a simple test. And I think many people are drawn to measuring simple things because it's easy to do. And in a world of complicated diagnostic reasoning, that's not complicated. You send a test. Most places, it's relatively quick to measure an ammonia level, and it's high or it's not. But there, you know, there is controversy on the clinical utility of this in different scenarios. So let me give you three possibilities, and you tell me what you think on the clinical utility of measuring, you know, serum, is, or I guess it's a plasma ammonia level, in those circumstances. So the first is a cirrhotic patient. The second is acute liver failure. And the last is someone like this who has sort of undifferentiated altered mental status and normal or normal-ish LFTs. Maybe they're a little abnormal, but not so abnormal that you would call this acute liver failure, and that would be a different matter. So the cirrhotic patient. Many people would say this is not a useful test. It does not correlate well with clinical problems like encephalopathy. What do you think?
It's not about the ammonia spikes. And you'll see a transient spike in ammonia that comes down may not always correlate with encephalopathy. But an ammonia burden, sustained elevated ammonia, certainly has its correlation with encephalopathy. And this paradigm is changing a little bit. There's this new movement of the MNHE, which is trying to use ammonia as a way to monitor hepatic encephalopathy in patients with cirrhosis.
You're saying if we could measure someone's ammonia every day for the past month, it would probably correlate well with their current encephalopathic picture, but the level on admission is not as helpful maybe.
Yeah, well, I think you think about hepatic encephalopathy as an onion with lots of layers, right? So there are a lot of false neurotransmitters and metabolites that are accumulating because of your liver dysfunction. And then there's this overlap of inflammation. The only biomarker we can measure to date is ammonia. So it's hard to use it exclusively as a marker of the level of mentation in a patient. But we do know that ammonia is toxic at really high levels. And if it's sustained and elevated, it could cause, you know, irreversible injury only at really extreme levels in cirrhotic patients. And clinically, certainly using it to monitor a standard HE patient on the floor or in ICU, it isn't quite clear yet. There needs to be more studies to kind of iron that out. Is it going to be useful there? But if you have someone who is having persistent hepatic encephalopathy or is worsening, then there's more utility, I think, to checking an ammonia level. If it's sustained and elevated, especially when you've used your standard interventions to treat them, like, you know, lactulose rifaximin, treating the underlying cause, then it would be something to monitor and then think about trying to, you know, approach ways to lower the ammonia.
Okay, so maybe in this context, this test is like a lot of our non-specific tests we use in complex comorbid patients, like a urinalysis for bacteria or a D-dimer or maybe a troponin, in that it will be abnormal in most or all of these patients. That alone is probably not helpful.
Right.
It may be more diagnostically useful if it is truly normal or extremely high. But otherwise, if the question you're asking is this patient encephalopathic today because of hepatic encephalopathy, it's probably not going to answer that on its own.
Yeah, exactly. I think that you could have HE with a low ammonia, or the ammonia was transient and it decreased. There certainly could be other overlapping causes for that elevated ammonia.
And as a marker of a response to therapy, maybe it's useful. So you're treating them a few days, you're making them poop and so on. If their ammonia has, let's say, not come down, that may be a marker that your therapy's not working, for instance.
Yeah, or it would be a reason to try and figure out why this is elevated. So the ones, you know, in the ICU context, so the ones I'm particularly worried, a cirrhotic patient I'm particularly worried about is the patient who comes in with shock, with multiple presses, and they have a gut, you know, a variceal bleed, and the gut's full of blood, right? And these patients when you have, you know, generally blood is a cathartic agent, and you know, so with your standard lactulose, you know, the blood passes out quickly once the bleeding is stopped. But when you have that really shocky variceal bleeder, there's also decreased gut motility, and then blood stays within the lumen. This scenario can generate ammonia really high. And when sustained and high, you know, above 150, 200, you can have a small number of these cirrhotic patients run into problems with brain injury from sustained elevated ammonia levels. So it will tell you to, you know, at least give you some guidance in terms of, you know, maybe we should be more aggressive with the gut clearance, like using things like polyethylene glycol, you know, to try and get the blood out of the gut.
So then turning to the next category, the patient with truly acute liver failure, maybe some acute on chronics, but, you know, the gold picture would be the, you know, acetaminophen toxicity, something like that. I think many people say this is a good time to measure ammonia levels because it answers some practical questions. For instance, it correlates with their risk of cerebral edema and so on. You think this is a good group for measuring this?
Absolutely. There's now multiple studies that have shown a correlation between the development of cerebral edema in acute liver failure with high ammonia levels. And this ranges from ammonia of more than 100 or more than 150 and more than 200, right? So most centers use 150 as the threshold to be concerned about, you know, sort of the development of acute intracranial hypertension in acute liver failure. So it's something that we follow very closely and try to control these levels in this patient.
And, you know, maybe we can explain this as simply as, just like in most situations, it's always easier to interpret abnormal tests in the setting of a more normal patient. So a normal liver that is hyperammonemic today, that probably is more of more clear relevance than a patient with a chronically poor liver who is maybe more hyperammonemic today. And oftentimes they tolerate it less, right? One of the questions is always like, maybe this patient has somewhat adapted to having these abnormal levels. Is that the case in cirrhotics? They're somewhat more used to this?
Yeah, I think we think so. But you know, is there a conclusive, you know, study that shows the difference? We don't. I think the one thing to consider is this. So why is ammonia important in ALF versus chronic liver failure? More important, I would say, is that in acute liver failure, there is this, the liver is on fire. So there's this necrotic liver that's releasing cytokines. There's a cytokine storm that is occurring in conjunction with this hyperammonemia. This causes things like MMP9 and other factors that cause weeping of fluid into the interstitial space, kind of like a patient with CAR T therapy, for instance, right? So you now have this interstitial edema or vasogenic edema from fluid weeping into the interstitial space, and you have this second hit from ammonia causing intracellular and also interstitial edema from that, like, glutamine accumulation and some mitochondrial dysfunction. So it almost becomes a double whammy. You don't get that kind of that cytokine storm in your chronic cirrhosis patients.
So then the final group would be the patient sort of like this, where someone has an altered mental status and we don't really know why, and so we're just sending tests. And the way I describe that should give anyone pause, because we're not making kind of good use of the Bayesian reasoning here. Ideally, you form some kind of a pretest probability for a diagnosis before you start testing for it. But it sometimes this can play a role. Of course, hyperammonemia can cause altered mental status. We all agree about that. But in a patient without a clear liver disease, I mean, that's mostly what we've talked about so far, I think a lot of people wouldn't know what to do with high ammonia if it did result. So do you think this is something that we should consider in that category of people? And then we can talk about what to do with it if it is abnormal. But
yeah, if you have unexplained mental status, it's absolutely reasonable to get an ammonia level. Certainly if it's elevated, You need to work through an algorithm and trying to figure out why it's elevated, but it's easy enough test. If it's not elevated, it points to other things to look at, right?
One of the caveats people will raise sometimes about measuring this is that it's a technically difficult test to do. There are practical reasons why it can be hard to get reliable measurements of this. Do you have any thoughts on this, either caveats or just tips for doing it right?
Yeah. In the outpatient world, it's a very tough test, right? Because it sits in a clinic and then it takes a while to get to the lab, right? But in an inpatient setting, if your lab can process ammonia, then as long as it's a protocolized approach, right, you get the draw. It doesn't matter if it's arterial or venous. They have a mild difference, but they track. And if you can get it to the lab quickly, ideally on cold water or ice, right, and gets processed right away. So the lab needs to be, have a system where they prioritize ammonia draws the minute they get there and it gets done. So if it's not difficult to do, and in the hospitals where that they have a system for it, it's done very easily. Suddenly, middle of the night, someone draws pneumonia, doesn't know, it sits around for too long and you get erroneous elevated pneumonia. And the easiest thing to do is just recheck the level.
So yeah. The biggest caveat is if it sits around too long, it may be falsely high.
Yeah.
But within inpatients, unless someone really just leaves it around, by and large, it's not like you have 10 seconds to run it or something.
No, generally. You just put it on ice, stick it down, yeah, and then it gets processed. It doesn't sit around in the lab for too long, yeah.
So, let's take a patient like this. Let's say you're walking around with your team, maybe you hop on the elevator and your student says, listen, I don't understand this ammonia level. This patient is not like I know maybe the LFTs are a little weird or something, but I don't know how to interpret this. What sorts of causes could drive hyperammonemia in a patient like this, other than the obvious ones, which, as far as we know, are not present? What sort of things do you think through?
The primary processing for ammonia in the liver is the urocycle. So is this something that has affected the urocycle, or is this something, or is it being generated from excessive production of ammonia, right? So those are the two big areas. Once you've excluded acute liver failure and cirrhosis, right? There are numerous extra hepatic causes for hyperammonemia. So let's start there first. Things that we don't think about are, for instance, cardiac arrest, right? A patient with cardiac arrest and you check an ammonia right after, it's going to be elevated, especially if the duration to ROSC was prolonged. You have depletion of ATP, ATP forms ADP, and through the adenylate cyclase conservation, it tries to make two ADPs become ATP. What's left is your AMP. AMP is deaminated to IMP, and it releases ammonia. So you get this rapid ammonia accumulation in blood. Another example of that is gut ischemia. There's an analogy. Ammonia is the lactate of the gut. The enterocytes use glutamine as their primary source of energy, right? And then convert it eventually to citrulline, which is through an enzyme CPS1. When you have gut ischemia, it's able to operate the first part of the series of reactions, but not be able to convert it to citrulline in the end, which requires energy in the mitochondria. And this generates ammonia, just like glycolytic pathway in anaerobic respiration would generate lactate. It generates ammonia in the process. In the context of the case was a gastric bypass. We know that patients with a gastric bypass, especially years after the gastric bypass, and associated with severe malnutrition, can develop hyperammonemia. We also know that there are other things that can cause hyperammonemia, such as medications. We can have urease-producing organisms producing hyperammonemia. We can also have patients, for instance, with increased muscle activity. You have a seizure patient or someone who had rhabdo, right? They can both, intense muscle activity can break down muscle and generate a lot of nitrogen, which can manifest as a transient hyperammonemia. And you have, like, for instance, that especially the rhabdo example, a heat stroke patient has a double whammy. They have an acute liver hit and they have rhabdo, and they can have really high ammonias exceeding 600, 700, and they're treated more like an acute liver failure in that context, but just to know that, that's the thing. And then you think about inborn errors of metabolism. Certainly that's more in the pediatric population where urea cycles is dysfunctional. And you can get adult onset urea cycle disorders, but these are, you know, the minority. They're not very common, but they are something in the differential. And then your drugs, you know, your most common drug overdose, which is that causes hyperammonia, is valproate overdose, which gives you high ammonia without a transaminitis. Things like shunting that happens. So typically you'll see a podocytomic shunt with cirrhosis patients, but you can sometimes develop shunts outside of cirrhosis in scenarios like trauma, hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia, where you lose the first pass effect of the liver, where ammonia now bypasses the liver. You can have an abscess with a urease producing organism. Like I had a burn patient with a protease abscess in the thigh. So it was generating ammonia, but it bypassed the liver because it wasn't in the enterohepatic circulation. So it constantly produced hyperammonemia until the abscess could be drained, right? So I think, you know, walking down this broad differential and trying to pinpoint, based on the story, what's going on in the patient.
Okay, so let me summarize that if I can.
Yeah.
If people think through this process, and they don't have to memorize all these causes, just thinking through it physiologically, they will probably find that if they understand the different ways you can clear ammonia, that highlights the possibilities for pathology. So we talked about, oh, your liver's not working. Okay, maybe your gut's not working, and that may go beyond, you know, the patient's just not stooling enough, but maybe their muscles are not, quote, working. And that might include a patient who just doesn't have very much muscle, a sarcopenic patient,
right,
or a state like rhabdo where they've had muscle breakdown. Maybe there are, of course, metabolic dysfunctions, such as you said, the pediatric patient or most famously valproate. Two of the things that I'd like to highlight, which I feel like are not as obvious, are the role of infections and the role of nutrition. Infections, and you mentioned urease-producing organisms, and many people, if they think back to their micro, can maybe list some of these or at least know that they exist. But these are, you know, a lot of common pathogens, and most people are not thinking, oh, could this be causing hyperammonemia? So are you saying a patient who is infected with any of these bugs, let's say just have a UTI or something, that alone can elevate their ammonia level? Or would this be usually in somebody who also has some compromise to their ability to metabolize it, like the cirrhotic patient who also has an infection, let's say?
For most part, a patient, let's say, coming to an ICU with sepsis, your blood cultures are going to capture it, your broad-spectrum antibiotics are going to treat it, right? So you may get, let's say, a Pseudomonas sepsis, and the Pseudomonas organisms has a urease enzyme, you may get a transient hyperammonemia that you may not even realize. But it's less significant because you're treating it pretty quickly and it clears very fast and it's not so much an issue, right? Where it's particularly an issue is in a recalcitrant organism, or one that's like compartmentalized like in an abscess that is producing it without effectively treating it, right? But the one that is particularly important that your blood cultures may not catch is uroplasma or mycoplasma, right? And this is particularly important in your immunocompromised or transplant population, right? Generally, uroplasma is more of a urinary tract organism or can even be sexually transmitted. But in transplant population, it can become disseminated, right? It can be in lung transplants, for instance. There's post-lung transplant hyperammonemia where they have this pneumonia involving uroplasma, but it's not very clinically significant. They don't have your typical clinical features of ammonia, where hypoxemia and infiltration, all they have is a high ammonia. So the story for this is someone comes in from a home, gets a lung transplant, and immediately after your lung transplant, you're able to, they wake up and they are communicating, and you know, and then within 48 hours into it, they become more encephalopathic, and then someone checks the ammonia and it's like, 200, 300, and it can spike as high as 1,000 I've seen before in these patients. And the mortality used to be very high. It used to almost be in the 90% mortality range, because we really didn't understand the cause of this hyperammonemia until some smart people from the Mayo Clinic figured out that this is disseminated urine plasma or mycoplasma, right? And the reason is your blood cultures are negative. Your vancomycin, meropenem, mycofungin is not going to touch it, right? Because the treatment of choice is doxycycline, azithromycin, or levoquin, right? So a lot of these patients died because it just wasn't recognized for negative blood culture. So it was assumed it wasn't really infectious, and they don't really always present with an infection picture. So they don't have spiking fevers and shock and so on initially, until that ammonia is like profoundly elevated. Certainly with recognition of this, we now know that both ureaplasma, which is a urease producing organism, and mycoplasma is not actually urease, it's an adenosine deaminase, and both of these degenerate hyperammonemia in this context, and they require a PCR to test for them. So you can do a PCR on your BAL, a PCR on urine, and the Mayo Clinic has a PCR on blood as well, but they all send out, so you have to have a high index of suspicion and empirically treat these patients until the testing comes back.
The two pearls here are the patient who has an infection with some bug, which is urease producing, which is not readily cleared. Some site that is persistent, it's walled off somewhere or hard to clear. And many times you'll know that. You know, it's something you're working on. It may not be per se a huge, like, let's say they're not, frankly, septic, but you're aware of that. And they're encephalopathic. You might consider that this could be dry. And of course, you would just check the ammonia levels, but that would tie that diagnosis together. And then secondly, a patient who could be infected with mycoplasma, or more specifically uroplasma, which is usually going to be like a transplant or otherwise immunosuppressed patient. So, perhaps a patient like this on rituximab, that too could be a driver of an elevated ammonia level in a situation where the infection otherwise might not be, again, all that relevant. This might be the main clinical sequela, and therefore the only real marker of the problem. And again, it's always most important to think about these things when you're not just treating it accidentally. You're probably not going to treat these atypical bugs with your broad spectrum agents unless you think to, provide atypical coverage. So maybe you can confirm that diagnosis if you have the right sort of tests. Maybe you just have to think about it and add the right antibiotics, but something to reflect on for those people.
And it's funny, the case that you gave me had a patient with rheumatoid arthritis. Uroplasma can cause a septic arthropathy as well. And I've seen numerous of these cases where when you do a joint tap, and it shows that it's inflammatory, but nothing ever grows. Then it's assumed to be a seronegative arthritis, and then they're given more immunosuppression to treat it. And then that uroplasma that is located limited to a joint now becomes disseminated, and then they present with hyperammonemia and become obtunded from the process, right?
Well, now I'm thinking everyone I admit on rituximab, I should check their ammonia levels. But
I don't know about that, but I think if you have a if you're obtunded on rituximab, it's reasonable. And especially a history of this, what looks like a septic arthropathy that doesn't grow in an immunocompromised patient, that's something to think about in the back of your mind.
So the other group that I wonder about is the nutritional issues.
Yep.
So this person has a gastric bypass, and perhaps there are other nutritional deficiencies that can cause this. But that it's far from obvious how that works. How do nutritional deficiencies lead to this?
Yeah, I think there's still a lot unknown about it. But we do know that this goes on. This takes. It's not something that happens immediately after gastric bypass. It's years after a gastric bypass. We do know that in the 60s they did the gastrocolic bypasses, which were bypassed large amount of small bowel, and these patients did poorly in the sense that they developed acute liver dysfunction, steatosis, and what the historical literature calls it acute liver failure, but they didn't really have the classic transaminitis and all of that. Bypassing short, small bowel somehow causes this this entity, especially when there's severe malnutrition involved. Why is the case? It remains unclear. One, it was always thought to be, well, maybe an underlying urocycle dysfunction, but over time, we've seen that only a minority of these patients have an inborn error of metabolism or urocycle enzyme deficiency of some sort. Then it's thought that they have micronutrient deficiency that drives it, something like zinc or copper or carnitine. And suddenly these things may be decreased because they're malnourished, right? And the absorption is affected. But there's not one particular micronutrient has been clearly implicated in all of this case. What we do know is that these patients are almost always steatotic. They have a very steatotic liver when they present, and they often get labeled as MAFLD or MASH, because the treatment you assume for most MAFLD is or MASH is weight loss, and these patients don't need weight loss, right? They need to gain mass, right?
So you're saying these patients, they may have signs of liver disease, steatosis,
yep,
but it is due to malnutrition.
Exactly. So when they have rapid malnutrition, you've seen this historically in patients with the classic kwashiorkor, right? And they, you'll see these pictures of big livers in kids and so on. These are steatotic livers in severe malnutrition, right? And they're not, and there is so some synthetic dysfunction there affecting beta oxidation or lipid metabolism, right? That indirectly affects the urocycle. Whether it's essential fatty acid deficiency, which can cause, like we have essential amino acids, we have essential fatty acids.
But these people will have all the findings of liver disease you would expect from another cause, whether it's changes on imaging, maybe abnormal labs, or if you were to biopsy it, the same sort of pathologic findings.
Yeah, so here, they will have just a very steatotic liver. And suddenly, if it persists down the road, you can have what we call a burnout steatosis.
If someone's like, I don't understand, how can nutritional problems cause a high ammonia? You say, well, it's simple. It causes liver disease, steatosis. But it's just due to malnutrition and not due to alcohol or one of these more common causes. Now, I'm sure some of these people can have multiple problems. Maybe they also drink. Maybe they're also sarcopenic and so on and so forth.
Yeah, but. Yeah. No, I think suddenly the liver disease is a big, the steatosis is a big component, but they also have this overwhelming catabolic state, right? So in isolation, I don't think it's liver disease alone. They come in, they're the ones that manifest with this hyperammonemia after gastric bypass are usually patients who been, teetering along, eating minimally, right, and they have significant weight loss over the last 4 or 5 months, and then something pushes them over the edge where they were barely functional, and all of a sudden they're now profoundly catabolic. It could be an infection, a tipping point is usually an infection of some sort that leads them there. And yes, these patients are profoundly catabolic, right? So when you're breaking down muscle mass because you're catabolic. And you can't clear this ammonia, right? Because your liver is dysfunctional. Then it manifests in this ammonia, elevated ammonia per se.
It sounds like this is mostly, or the majority of these cases have been described maybe after gastric bypasses. But can this occur in any malnourished patient? You have the person with a short gut or a person who is simply anorexic for any reason, even just the elderly patient with failure to thrive who's not eating. I mean, can any severe malnutrition cause this?
It has to be pretty profound, right? Malnutrition. It's particularly, you'd see it in patients with malabsorption, for instance. We see a lot of short gut patients in ICU, right? But very rarely do they present with hyperammonemia. This, the only explanation I have for this is that the main production of ammonia is from your enterocytes, right? So circulating glutamine that bathes the small bowel gets converted to ammonia in the process. And these patients have significantly shortened small bowel, so that production of ammonia, I think, from those enterocytes are significantly dampened. And the only rationale I know why we don't see it in the short gut patients specifically. In elderly patients, they don't develop malnutrition profoundly enough that they have this 90%, 80% steatotic liver.
So it's a progressive, longer standing problem most part. This is not like you don't have a nutrient so you don't convert it into something. It's changes in your body secondary to your malnutrition that eventually lead to this.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that there may be something to do with the bypassing the gut. Certainly there's a concept of bacterial overgrowth, but really no one's really confirmed that there's this blind loop of bowel causing bacterial overgrowth that drives some of this, right? It hasn't really been flushed out, but that is one etiology that, that's marked up. But something like essential amino acids, for instance, essential fatty acids, it's hard to become fatty acid deficient. All you need is a very little amount of fatty acid.
So circling back to our patient, maybe that this is really what you're entertaining. It's related to the bypass and a nutritional issue. You do see signs of some steatosis on a CT scan. And so you say, well, we're going to treat it as if that's the case. And your intern says, all right, well, I'm going to give her lactulose and rifaximin and end of list. What other things might you do in a patient like this differently than the kind of that routine cirrhotic patient? How are you going to fix this problem?
They come in obtunded, the ammonia is elevated. First thing is, we don't want to make that ammonia worse. We're in a protein is good world where everyone gives protein to everyone. So this is one patient population that you'd want to be careful with the protein. Yes, we know they are malnourished and they're catabolic, and you think giving protein is going to improve that, but it could worsen the ammonia. By giving protein, it's going to increase the ammonia because they can't deal with the waste, right, at this point. So we'll check the same urea cycle function, things like making sure they don't have an inborn error of metabolism, the standard amino acid panel, looking at your orotic acid and your serum amino acid. So make sure that these are all sent off in case if there's an abnormality in these panels, they may point towards an underlying urea cycle disorder. But in most of these cases, there isn't that problem, right? So here, we want to keep the ammonia from climbing up. So we start giving calories in the form of dextrose and fat, right? And avoid protein, right? The question of zero protein or minimal protein is arguable. From my standpoint, I tend to start, especially if the ammonia is above 100, 150, I tend to start with zero protein and just give them calories in terms of carbohydrates and fat, right? And this can be initially in the form of intralipids and calories in the form of dextrose. And then replete all the micronutrients. You never want to give dextrose without giving thymine, right? So you just send a thymine level and assume they have underlying Wernicke's, to put them a high dose thymine. And we send a whole bunch of micronutrient levels off. We start some empirically and the others we wait for the micronutrient levels to come back, right? And particular ones that we start empirically are things like B6, liver carnitine. We all get levels for these things before we start, and then empirically start these start repleting these. Then we look at reintroducing the protein, right, and see if they are tolerant. They can be tolerant of this protein, right? There are different ways to do this. Some prefer using the gut for this process. In our hospital, we have a protocol to you, but it uses parenteral nutrition preferentially. And the reason we use parenteral nutrition is because we can titrate the protein very precisely. We can start small amounts and see and look to see if the ammonia rebounds with that, right? And then generally increase it gradually over a couple of days, right? Now, so if your ammonia is not controlled at all, you've come in really high ammonia levels, you know, the move to using dialysis to control the ammonia levels is common. It's not driven by a lot of data. It extrapolated from pediatric urea cycle disorder kids where there is, you know, guidelines that support its use of dialysis, right? But again, those studies are based on low quality evidence, right? There has been a big randomized control study looking at, efficacy of CRT. We know ACRT will reduce ammonia, but whether it changes outcomes is unclear. It's like if you clear osmoles in your serum too quickly, whilst your astrocytic, glutamine is high and your interstitial glutamine is high, you could shift water into the brain and precipitate swelling. So that would argue to doing it earlier before you sit at an ammonia of 200 or 300 for like 4 days and then trying to start in a CRT then, right? If you do start it late, I tend to use some hypertonics in that context, you know, just to offset the osmolar difference. Again, there's no data for that except to extrapolate from acute liver failure, where we use hypertonics routinely in the context of initiation of CRT, because we do know that CRT will clear osmoles and in the blood and causes differential between the interstitium intracellular versus the blood and causes shift of fluid back, right? What you want to avoid is the perfect storm, which is you start the treatment and your ammonia is down. The nutrition team sees it and says, hey, this person's ammonia is better, let's increase the protein. The IC team sees it and says, hey, enteral feeding is better than parenteral feeding, let's start cranking up the vital high, you know, protein tube feeds in the gut. And then the renal team sees this ammonia and says, hey, let's cut down this dialysate flow rate since the ammonia is under control. This three perfect storm can cause a rebound in ammonia and you know, suddenly cause problems, you know, causing brain edema. We had, you know, there's a risk of herniation in this context too when ammonia bounds too quickly.
So ultimately, this patient needs to be better nourished. That's what's driving their problem. But acutely, they can't take a big load of protein. It's just more nitrogen that's going to feed their ammonia problem. Yeah. So you need to start them kind of with near zero protein and then introduce it once they're a little more stable.
Yeah.
You talk about supplementing some of these micronutrients, thiamine, L-carnitine, B6. Is that because that will fix the problem or just because you expect someone this malnourished is likely to be deficient in many things?
Yeah, they are likely to be deficient in many things. I don't think the thiamine will fix anything, but they're probably thiamine deficient. The one specific to ammonia metabolism is your liver carnitine. Zinc, these are involved in ammonia metabolism directly and indirectly, and then copper also indirectly through mitochondrial function. So these are more specific to this, but they don't quite explain this entity altogether. So, but they are certainly ones that we routinely want to replete if they're low in this patient population. They would tell you that I was eating okay. 4 or 5 months ago, right? And I reached a point I couldn't eat anymore. I would eat a little bit and it wouldn't stay in, I'd throw up, and the assumption that something anatomical is going on with the gut, right? They're unable to keep things down anymore, but when you image them, nothing's changed, right? What's really happened is they hit a critical point where they became micronutrient deficient, and that is affecting their gut motility, and the gut stops working. So especially when you get these patients better, the assumption that, well, they need to reverse the gastric bypass, everything, because they're not able to eat anymore. But once you replete all of that, you give them a meal once you get through all of it, and they're actually able to eat and swallow, and it's because they do have this critical threshold that has passed where the micronutrient deficiency is so profound that their motility is also affected from it. Does that make sense?
So they're like many chronically critically or ill patients where they're this nutritional status, feeding this potential complication is probably tenuous. And they might tip over from various things. But most cases, they can be adequately nourished to avoid problems like this as long as you manage these things. Keep their gut moving, keep their nutrition reasonable and so
exactly,
on.
Exactly, yeah. In some patients, you know, certainly they'll require more aggressive intervention like going and redoing the gastric bypass, or even that there are more endoscopic options right now where you can go in and try and create a bypass between the... And I've seen this steatosis go away. I mean, they've gone from 80% steatosis to down to 30% steatosis on follow-up biopsies in this patient. So they do reverse with time if you catch them in that early enough. Yeah.
All right. In most cases, this shouldn't progress to needing a transplant or something. It's a reversible problem. Not that not all reversible problems are reversible, but in principle. Can we reasonably say that a possibility like this is not likely? If, let's say this patient has a CT scan like all of our ICU patients do, and their liver looks totally normal. I mean, if they have a really truly healthy looking liver, does this diagnosis not really make sense?
We don't have a critical mass of these patients to know. The patients I've seen, most of them have steatosis, I would say, right? The ones that don't have steatosis can have burnout steatosis. So that liver, at some point, it starts to become fibrotic and then it loses that fat. So it's hard to completely base it on the liver, the size of the liver. Also, to gauge steatosis with a CT, there's some limitations, right? It has to be big, but it's helpful when it's there. It's unclear, you know, when it's not, at least on a CT scan.
Yeah, and certainly like all tests, you can probably improve the test characteristics if you try. For instance, if you just scan all your ICU patients and your question is, patient is sick, the radiologist is not going to look for this. But if you then have a conversation, you say, hey, does this look like this liver has any steatosis? That might be a different question.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's the same where, you know, in the cirrhotic story at portosystemic shunting, if you don't ask about shunting, they don't always report there's a big splenorenal shunt causing your hyperemia. So you literally have to go back down and talk to the radiologist and say, is that a big splenorenal? Because it's so common in that they don't really, you know, report it unless you're... they know to look for it. Yeah.
We have to wrap, but that just reminds me. I have to ask: shunting, any cause of arteriovenous shunting could cause hyperammonemia. For example, the dialysis patient who has an established shunt for their access. I mean, can this cause hyperammonemia just by bypassing the liver?
It has to be a shunt between your enteric circulation and your systemic circulation. So it has to be bypassed the first pass effect of the liver. So an intra-abdominal process will do that. Or compartmentalization of an abscess, for instance, somewhere else outside of the enterohepatic, so where the organism is actually producing. So it has to be something producing ammonia outside the enterohepatic circulation.
Because any other shunt, the blood is still going to end up passing through the liver.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be a second pass effect and all that. But I just think of it as a metabolism of a drug, right? It's the right. Same concept. Yeah, and I think your first question was about rifaximin lactulose, right? I only comment I want to make here is that the common picture is this. So you put them, I've seen this numerous times where the patient comes in, they'll treat them with enteric feeding, right? And slowly, if you're lucky, you get the ammonia under control just by getting them anabolic enough. But they also use a lot of lactulose to try and keep the gut ammonia production down. But this is a very short-lived intervention, because if you send these patients home with lactulose, they already have a shortened gut, so to speak, because of the bypass, right? And now it's the transit time is even shorter, and they are going to only get more malnourished when they leave the hospital, and they're going to keep coming back to the hospital multiple times. So that's what you use in cirrhosis can't be applied here. The focus here is the nutritional corrections.
Plus, I mean, you're filling up their small stomach with lactulose four times a day. So
Can I mention one more thing, which I left up? It's just the use of urocycle scavengers, right? Sodium benzoate, sodium phenylacetate. We didn't talk about it at all, but the general rule is you want to ideally have intact renal function to use them, because it basically converts ammonia, which can't be excreted by the kidneys. Ammonia has to be converted to urea, so it bypasses this process by changing it to something called PAGN, and this can be cleared by your kidneys, right? So ideally, they are used in scenarios where your kidney function is intact. Do we routinely use it in patients? Not necessarily. I don't. I still stick with the nutrition management.
I'm going to be honest, I've never even heard of these drugs. So this is like it's like giving Vaptans for hyponatremia or something. It doesn't really fix anything, but it might speed up your process a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for this. We'll leave it at that. Remind everyone, this is just sort of our own opinions on this. We're not representing any of our institutions, and just some general educational content. We're not giving you any personal advice. That's your problem. We'll talk to you guys next time. Thank you.